Thank you. Anlaşılmayan bir şey ama da yine de Da, Pari Irigun, Polorit, Pari Egak. I'm very happy, excuse me, I'm very happy to introduce to you our speaker tonight. Dr. Hasmik Khalapyan teaches Armenian history at the American University of Armenia. She is the academic director of AGBU Armenian Virtual College and the editorial director of the college's multimedia e-book series. After earning her MA from Miami University, not in Miami, Florida, but in Ohio, I was just informed, she received her PhD from Central European University in Budapest, that is in Hungary. She has carried out research in Ottoman history in archives and libraries across far-flung locations from Armenia to France, Turkey, and Austria. Her research interests include concepts and histories of social change in local and global perspectives, 19th and 20th century Ottoman history, global women's movements in comparative perspective, theories and histories of empires and colonialism, as well as gender and international law. As you can see, she is a woman of many hats, and she has published widely in international journals in English as well as in translation in Turkish. Today she will be speaking to us for about 45 or so minutes on the topic of marriage law and marriage culture among Western Armenians, 1860 to 1908. Please join me in welcoming her. And I forgot to also mention that she's a veteran here at UCLA. I was just told that she has been She participated several times in the graduate students conferences. She even taught here for 1 year. And so let's give her a hand. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the introduction and for having me here. It's always a privilege to be back to UCLA and louder. Okay. Always a privilege to be at UCLA, and I see all these professors that whose works I've admired, and it's so good to have you here. Thank you so much for coming. So today I will be speaking about marriage law and marriage culture among Ottoman Armenians between 1860s to 1908. The Patriarch Hrimian, better known to us as Hrimian Haidik, is this loud enough? There is no microphone, I realize. Yeah? No? Not good?
I can hear.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. We'll move over this way. You can also hear.
Yeah. Okay. Patriarch Hrimian, better known to us as Hrimian Haidik, reflecting on the four years of his patriarchate between 1869 and 1873, wrote in his memoirs, quote, "O Armenian nation, during the 4 years of my patriarchate, I personally witnessed the numerous disasters of your families. And in those disasters, the most unbearable were the issues concerning marriage," end of quote. A few decades later, in 1894, under pressure to settle a divorce case, a member of the Ottoman Armenian National Assembly's Religious Council stated in frustration, quote, "For God's sake, let this divorce be put off until the next election of the council. Let this not happen while we're serving as council members," end of quote. This reluctance had its root in a number of factors, including absence of a comprehensive marriage law between 1860 and 1908, the inability of the Armenian authorities to reinforce legal decisions, and the ever-changing cultural values that the popular legal attitudes failed to address. In my talk today, I will give an overview of the legal and cultural dimensions of marriage and family. I will illustrate that the efforts to modernize family and marriage evolved around power struggles between the clergy and laymen on one hand, and between the Ottoman, between the Armenian community and the Ottoman state on the other, often transcending the issue of marriage itself. In the course of the 19th century, marriage was a religious act, carried out and registered by the local church. The marrying couple made various donations to the church, the size of which was determined in accordance with the social status of the family. The income from these donations added to the national treasury and was reported to the National Assembly. Arranged forced marriages was a common practice. Marriage was a contractual relation between two families rather than the marrying couple. The complex legal systems and power structures both within and without the Armenian community created confusion and incomprehension over reform and law on family and marriage. The Ottoman socio-political reforms between 1839 and 1876, known as the Tanzimat reforms, and the Ottoman Civic Code of 1869 created legal tensions among the secular and religious authorities of the Ottoman state. These tensions resulted in the creation of a dual legal system, according to which secular courts were to function under the auspices of the Ministry of Justice, whereas religious courts were to remain under the jurisdiction of the Sheikhul Islam or Sheikh al-Islam, the superior authority in issues of Islam. Issues concerning personal status, such as marriage, divorce, alimony, and inheritance, remained with the religious courts and were resolved in line with the Sharia, the Islamic law. What did the Ottoman context mean for the legal system of the Armenian community? The composition of the Armenian community itself bore a dual character. Armenians, similar to Greeks and Jews, were a recognized ethno-religious minority within the Ottoman state. Through the organization known as the millet system, the religious leader of each community was the head of the millet, as recognized by the Sultan. Things became complicated when the Armenian National Constitution of 1863 set up a national assembly comprised of religious and secular representatives. The national institutions were shared between the two segments, and mixed council, Father Hans Nafumbet, were established. The head of the National Assembly and the Armenian community at large remained the patriarch in so much as he was the only recognized leader of the community for the Ottoman Sultan. Thus, the constitution system itself bore a dual character, semi-religious and semi-secular. The National Assembly's Judicial Committee, which handled family and marriage disputes, consisted of 8 members, 4 religious and 4 secular, all of whom had to be married, be over 40, and no law, iravagetner. According to the Constitution, it was the duty of the Judicial Committee, quote, to resolve family disputes and trials passed to the Patriarchate by the Sublime Court, end of quote. If the Judicial Committee found the case beyond its comprehension, it had to pass the case to the religious, civil, or mixed councils. If appeal was filed against any of the verdicts of the Judicial Committee, the issue was to be reheard by any of the 3 mentioned councils as well. Thus, under the Constitution alone, family trials could go to the hands of practically any authority of the Armenian community, religious, secular, or semi-religious, semi-secular. The cases could also be heard at the Ottoman Muslim courts, to which Christians were free to take their cases. Moreover, what may have seemed a simple divorce case could go out of the borders of the Ottoman Empire. Given the subordination of the Ottoman Armenian Patriarch to the Armenian Catholicos at the Holy Eshmiadzin, within the Russian borders at that time, the Patriarch could often refer marital disputes of Ottoman Armenians to the Catholicos when he failed or was unwilling to take responsibility. This frequently resulted in conflicts at various levels, since Holy Eshmiadzin itself adjusted its laws to the Russian legislation, the Imperial Russian legislation, and was affected by the Russian culture of family and marriage. Clearly, the possibility of involvement of various powers in the settlement of a single case could not function cohesively. It resulted in tensions and misunderstandings on various levels, as I will talk about later. The common mood in the period, both among religious and secular authorities, was that the family was deteriorated by marriage crises, aratne, and the struggle was launched by the mentioned parties on legal and discursive levels to stop the, quote, microbes deteriorating our nation, end quote. Among the vices to fight against, the authorities identified child and early marriage. The patriarchal decree of 1811 had defined the legal age at 15 for boys and 12 for girls. The marriage age was raised to 20 for boys and 18 for girls in 1880 by the religious council. It was often difficult to determine the age of the marrying couple, since births were not regularly registered by the church, and the priest had to rely on the word of the marrying couple. The most criticized age-related practice was peshikesne, an agreement between the families of infants to have the children married when they reached puberty. Cases of peshikesne, despite the prohibition in 1811, were reported as late as 1906. Dowry was considered yet another vice by the authorities and reformers. The practice of it differed in the cities and rural areas. In rural areas, the groom's family was supposed to pay the bride's family what was called pashulat, head price, whereas in the cities, the bride was supposed to take drahoma, dramojit, or dowry in cash. Dowry was officially forbidden by the Patriarchate in 1850s, but the practice continued. The Religious Council's marriage regulation of 1875 strictly forbade the involvement of clergy in mediating dowry issues before marriage, but it did not forbid and could not stop the practice as a whole. Bashlut and drahoma were considered to be the reasons behind the decline in marriage rates, particularly among the socially more vulnerable families. The head price, the bashlut, often resulted in the kidnapping of a woman, by which the groom avoided paying the demanded amount to the bride's family. Reports from Yozgat, for example, show that the majority of marriage disputes were around bashlut, the head price. Religious conversion, as well as appeals to Muslim courts, mostly by Armenian women, were of great concern to the religious and secular authorities. Conversions occurred for the sake of getting a safer and more desirable solution to the case file. cases were reported when the couple would convert to Greek Orthodoxy and then reconvert to the Armenian Church upon the settlement of the dispute. To stop the practice, the religious council adopted a decree on 1906 refusing to accept reconversions. Polygamy was perhaps perceived as one of the most alarming unchristian vices. The cases of it were repeatedly reported in the provinces. It appears that the religious council was particularly zealous in stopping the cases of polygamy and less so other wrongdoings, such as child marriage, forced marriages, or dowry, etc. It was generally believed that the delay in settlement of marriage disputes and the refusal of divorce resulted in the practice. Often the husband, not granted the divorce, would take the second woman he wanted to marry to a church in a different location and get legally married to her without the dissolution of the first marriage. The refusal of divorce to the husband in case of infertility of the first wife likewise resulted in polygamy when the husband would bring home a second woman to ensure the continuation of family in the paternal line, of course. Legally, family and marriage disputes were subjected to the arbitrary case-by-case decisions. According to reports, so long the hearings took that a number of cases simply ended up with the death of one of the spouses. Permission to remarriage was likewise carried out on an arbitrary case-by-case level. Various reports of the religious and judicial committee show that in majority of cases, only either the husband or the wife was granted the right to remarry. As divorce was not the desirable outcome of a marriage, if it did occur, either the husband or the wife was denied the permission to remarry. Children's fate was apparently not discussed in the trials, or at least I have not seen this in the sources that I looked for. A major step to stop arbitrariness of the settlement of disputes and divorce cases was the decree of the Central Religious Council ratified by Patriarch Ormanian in 1907. However, with its typical for the period legal wording, the decree put an end neither to the prevailing confusions nor arbitrariness in marriage trials. Despite the fact that at various times, various decrees, decisions, and laws were adopted by the authorities of Armenian community, some of which I mentioned, the National Assembly and press reports show that no considerable step was taken to actually reinforce what was being discussed in terms of reform at different levels. This in turn resulted in the reiteration of the same problems and issues over and over again, with no actual improvement or progress. It led to a chaotic situation which was recognized both by the religious and secular authorities. All parties, traditionalist or progressive, recognized the family as the essence of the society and supported reform in family and marriage. The goal set ahead for stopping the family and marriage crisis was clear to all parties. What was not clear, however, was who had the lead and the say in the reform. Starting mid-19th century, reform of any kind that concerned the members of the Armenian community, including marriage, was increasingly understood in the language of secularism, and the church was often blamed for the persistence of ignorance and slow progress. The fact that the patriarch remained the recognized head of the Armenian millet, however, worked in the interest of religious authorities, who were in full awareness that in spite of the internal pressures, only decisions ratified by the patriarch had validity. The religious authorities continued enjoying privileges, such as in the case of the judicial committee, which despite its equal number of secular and religious representatives, was presided by the deputy patriarch, Patriarch Tikhonov. The official composition of the community as a religious unit in relation to the Ottoman state and the internal reforms towards further secularization created cleavages on multiple levels. Within the community, the cleavage rested upon a simple question: is marriage a private or a public institution? The religious authorities viewed public and secular as synonymous. For them, once marriage became a public concern, secular authorities would take over issues related to the institution. Their general argument was that marriage was a private and individual issue, therefore not subject to public discussion. The Religious Community Council deliberately reported on the statistics of marriage trials and disputes randomly and unsystematically, much to the concern of the secular members of the National Assembly. According to the religious statutes, the council would have reported marriage trials systematically and in detail if it was confident the report would stay behind the doors of the National Assembly. However, this was not the case. The periodical press of the time publicized the report. The religious members of the National Assembly believed that no good could be expected from such publications. Quote, in Europe, family violations and crimes are published regularly. Does this eliminate crimes violating the institution of marriage? No. And the quote is from the minutes of the National Assembly dated 1883. The fear of religious authorities that once made public the issue could acquire secular character was certainly justified, since public and secular were synonymous for the secular authorities too, who strive to secularize the institution exactly through opening the contemporary family and marriage situation to public debate. The secular deputies and reformers repeatedly disputed the practice of incomplete reports of the religious council. Quote, from the minutes of the National Assembly, 1885. How can public importance not be given to marital issues when in case of a divorce we say a home was dissolved, sooner contract? Does not the nation consist of these private families, and does not the nation get hurt with the gradual destruction of private families? Why should not the nation learn and have an idea about private lives? Why should we not know how many men divorce their wives and how many women divorce their husbands this year and for what reasons? End of quote. The drafting of a coherent legal framework was perceived by the religious authorities as a threat to their power, since secular deputies were to participate in the drafting and adoption of a law. Still back in 1875, the adoption of a draft law for marriage trials had been turned down with the excuse that, quote, the religious council has a law on everything else for marital trials, end of quote. Yet the trial statistics show that 90% of all trials, the judges did not refer to any specific law or regulations. When asked to identify the reasoning behind their decisions, their answers were they relied on their conscience. The arbitrariness of the decisions of religious council and the recurring complications in the way family and marriage disputes were settled presented an excellent opportunity for the secular segment to emphasize the incompetence of the religious authorities. The secular authorities pushed for the development of a unifying legal framework. In fear of being accused of abandoning Armenian tradition, they ensured the reform could not be understood as copying Europe. The legal framework had to be authentically Armenian, based on the local needs. Quote, Europe has perceived the marriage issue differently. Their perception does not concern us. We are an Asiatic nation, and we have to take care that marriage frauds gradually decrease in accordance to the rules of our church. End of quote. In their struggle for power, the secular authorities had all the support of the progressive literati that they needed. The intellectuals of the time launched a discursive campaign in the periodical press and fictional literature. In all their efforts, they strive to present marriage as a secular, public, rather than a religious, private institution, in which the religious authorities were to have no or very little say. It was believed that despite its religious perception, the forefathers of the Constitution had regarded marriage, quote, as a socio-political treaty for the organization of the institution of the family, quote. According to them, marriage could not be a purely religious institution because it involved material and money issues and required secular knowledge for the examination of trials of marriage. Yet challenging the religious domination was not an easy task ahead. Possessing an independent Christian church had resulted in the fusion of religion with national identity. Rejecting religious domination at all would require new definitions of a religion-free national identity. Under the domination of Islamic rulers, such an outcome was not in the interest of the reformers, since religion had been the demarking line preventing the intervention of Muslim rulers into matters characterized as cultural, and hence given Armenians a sense of cultural autonomy. One way of overcoming the dilemma was to argue that the domination of church was not historic. The journal Masses, for example, published in Constantinople, argued that the authority of religion over marriage contained, quote, anti-Armenian religious norms, which are foreign and entirely against the centuries-old traditions of the Armenian Church. The Armenian Church has never been a purely religious institution. It endured through centuries and owes its purity to the coexistence of religious and secular forces in it. The Armenian Church belongs to the people, to the secular, and for this reason, the appointed high clergymen have to consult with them, the people, and the secular authorities in decision-making. End of quote. Although it appears from the regulations and decrees that the religious council recognized the unequal position of women, this recognition was rare and not explicit. Moreover, a regulation seemingly in favor of women could in fact work against women's rights when communal practices and beliefs continued despite the regulations. This was the case, for example, with dowry in cash, the grafoma. Dowry in cash used to be the absolute property of the wife, and the husband could enjoy only the income from it. It would become the husband's property only after the death of the wife. Since the religious council forbade the intervention of the clergy into the dowry issues in 1875 and repeatedly in 1888, it refused to hear cases involving disputes over dowry with the excuse that the practice was illegal. This, in fact, worked against women since the practice continued, but there was no legal support to women to receive the money back upon divorce. In similar occasions, the reformers constantly emphasized women as the biggest victims and spoke of women's plight with concern. And I'm quoting, "It is impossible to deny that family and love dramas have increased in the Armenian society recently. And particularly, it is the young women who, at the cost of their blood, from time to time, come to spread in front of our eyes, in front of the eyes of an indifferent society, the hidden sufferings and woes we see every day, but we have neither the heart nor the time to deal with." End of quote. A particular concern was the weight of the fate of wives whose husbands had migrated, leaving the family with no support or information about their whereabouts. The abandoned women were considered as, quote, a wound on the body of the nation. As arguable as the issue of divorce was for other cases, quote, it is impossible to have two different opinions in cases of abandoned wives. It is necessary to support divorce, end of quote. The secularist campaign, however, was not very successful. Even though the judicial committee could refer cases either to the religious, civil, or mixed council, it is obvious from the report on marital trials that by the turn of the century, the religious council had become almost a sole actor in the field, concentrating decision-making power in its hands. The religious councils, for various decrees at various times throughout years, had made the judicial committee's decision subject to its final examination. The culmination of the council's attempt to centralize power in its hands was the decree of 1907, ratified by the patriarch without any consensus on the part of the civil council. Under the decree, the religious council no longer recognized recommendations from the Holy Echmiadzin compulsory and limited these recommendations to, quote, extreme cases. Secondly, the judicial committee in the provinces became practically dependent on the central judicial committee in Constantinople. Provincial committees were no longer authorized to issue decisions concerning marriage disputes, but were simply expected to refer the cases to Constantinople. The same year, the religious council stopped publishing marriage trial cases with the excuse that the exposure of the cases was unseemly both for those involved in the trial and the public. Thus, instead of secularization, in the early 20th century, marriage had increasingly become an institution dependent on religious authorities. Nevertheless, the struggle for power with outward victory of religious segments seemed insignificant when the autonomy of the Armenian community as a whole was at stake. The concept of Ottomanism on one hand and the weakening of figure of patriarch within the Armenian community on the other served as a favorable ground for the greater intervention of the Ottoman state into what has been hitherto considered strictly a cultural and religious issue. In the aftermath of the Paris Treaty of 1856, the Ottoman state distanced itself from trials involving Christians. At the turn of the century, however, the situation changed, and Christians were more and more comfortably using Muslim courts. The Sublime Court used to refer marriages addressed to it to the Armenian Patriarchate, but this practice stopped gradually toward the end of the century, and cases were no longer transferred to the Patriarchate. Instead, they found solutions in the Muslim courts. The Ottoman state's attempts of intervention resulted in the solidarity between the Armenian secular and religious authorities. If within the community the secular authorities pushed for the secularization of marriage, in relation to the Ottoman state, the opposite occurred. The religious dimension of marriage was emphasized by the Armenian authorities, both clergy and laymen, every time the Ottoman state intervention was to be prevented. Only through the rendering of marriage as a religious institution could the Ottoman intervention be prevented. Women occupied an ambiguous role in this tension. Armenian women were among those frequently referring cases to the Muslim courts because divorce was easier to obtain in the Muslim courts. With this choice, the Armenian women were opening opportunities for the Ottoman state intervention into the Armenian marriage matter. On the other hand, the frequent forced marriages of Armenian women to Muslim men, particularly in provinces, after the former were kidnapped and converted to Islam, served as a powerful engine for bringing Armenian religious and secular authorities together against the Ottoman ruler. In cases like this, the woman's honor and nation's honor were fused together. The incident could get importance for the community as a whole, and appeals would be filed all the way to the Sultan. Since the local Mufti, by virtue of Islam, was more powerful against the Christian local priest, the political powerlessness of Armenians was underscored in cases like this, resulting in more determination to prevent similar incidents by a strong and consistent legislation. With the revolution of 1908, and the re-establishment of the Ottoman parliament with a Muslim majority and a non-Muslim minority, attempts were made to draft a family and marriage law which was to cover all communities regardless of religion. Particular measures toward marriage legislation were taken up by the Ottoman parliament in 1911, which however confirmed the superiority of Islam over the minority religions when every suggestion made by non-Muslim parliamentarians were to be in accordance with the Sharia, the Islamic law. With the worsening of political tensions between the Armenians and Turks, marriage and family issues never got discussed in the Armenian National Assembly as seriously as they did in the 1880s and 1890s. And I will conclude. In the course of the 19th century, modernization of the family and improvements in the marriage law were on the national agenda, yet not an easy task to carry out. As Amira Sombol has illustrated in case of Egypt, when the state extends its authority over social relations, at the same time leaving issues concerning personal status within the jurisdiction of the religious authorities, the outcome would be, quote, the development of the economic and political sectors of the society towards more modern structures, while social and family laws would remain lagging behind, end of quote. Although reform and progress at large were understood in the language of secularism, marriage did not lose its religious importance. The complex hierarchy within the Armenian community on one hand and between the Ottoman Armenian community and the Ottoman state on the other rendered any discussion about marriage law politically charged. The analysis of the debates on all camps revealed that often these debates were about power and control. Within the Armenian community, it was the desperate hope of the clergy to hang on to the little power that they still possessed. In relation to the Ottoman state, managing the household embodied the political and administrative capability that provided training in governance that the Armenians no longer possessed in the larger imperial political sphere. For the Ottoman state, the Armenian clergy and the Armenian laymen likewise, the tensions in the legal reform were thus attempts to reestablish authority where it had weakened. Thank you.
Do you want to field the questions yourself? Or should
I can, yes, sure. Yes. Yes.
I really appreciate your presentation, particularly with regard to the detail that obviously you have for research this question in. But my impression is that obviously many of the sources which are available and all the developments within the Millet largely, of course, took place in Constantinople and were largely applied there and in some of the Western cities like Smyrna. So I was curious, first of all, basically to get a sense of what your investigation has clarified with regard to issues of women and marriage, particularly in the vast majority of the Armenian population out in those eastern barayas. As you indicated, clearly there the whole system of power was very different. So what if you could enlarge on that in terms of what you've been able to discover?
For women in the provinces?
Exactly.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, my research, I have not come across many sources that I could give you an answer now regarding provinces. Anyone who's worked, the reports were coming from the judicial committee that was founded in Constantinople, and they were limiting it to whatever they thought was more relevant for other councils to see. There were judicial committees also in the provinces, but I have not seen these reports. And for the scope of my research, the research that I was doing, it was more concentrated on Constantinople, so I did not go much after the sources for the Philae.
In connection with that, my name, I'm very curious about reports of the judicial committee. My understanding is that they are preserved in the patriarchy, but that access to them is quite problematic. I was wondering if you had access to those directly.
Yeah, I did spend time at the Patriarchate in Polis, as I was doing research for my PhD dissertation. I saw some at the Nubarian Library, some of these reports more, and I cannot remember right now if they also came out in the Patriarchate Library, but I would imagine that yes, because that's where I looked through the minutes of the National Assembly at the Polis, and I would imagine that some of these reports were also there, but I do not remember, sorry.
Yes, yes. Because I've been in touch with another graduate student who indicated that she was told exactly the term that you mentioned historically, that this was unseemly. That obviously the issues that were originally debated, and so all the more so that someone now should be raking through all those marital problems. So I'm curious to see whether in fact
but it was in the agenda,
opening up of those archival materials.
Some of these, depending on how these minutes of the National Assembly have been bound, some of these reports you could also find in these bound copies of the minutes of the National Assembly. Yes, and some I did find there as well. And I would imagine some came in from Polis, but I don't remember because it was long time ago. The original reports, yes.
Just to build up on Peter's question. My understanding is that there were petitions from the East as well to the patriarchy. And do you think some of the issues that Peter Pescali brought in terms of the women's situation in the countryside,
which is
kind of like a black box because we don't have the sources, do you think might be addressed if one had access to petitions? Do you think they might have addressed these questions in the petitions? Assuming if the petitions have survived and are still either in Istanbul or in Umbarium, which I have heard some of the archives are actually taken out of Istanbul and still they are today at Umbarium. Do you think if they have survived, these are questions that might have surfaced in petitions from the country?
Yes, absolutely so, and especially this is evident from the periodical press that would cover and often refer to this trial. Very often they take up a case and publicize it in the periodical. So yes, I would say yes to that. I would answer yes to that question.
And just another question, if I can. As far as the church is concerned and its role and its prerogative of overseeing women's issues. Just out of ignorance, maybe total ignorance, did the church have a code of laws or a code of conduct or a code of set of legal body of knowledge, religious, on women? And if so, where would those be? Or is this something that goes back ultimately to the Astrakhan code of laws, or even before that to the
I do not think, I have not seen any code of conduct, religious codes of conduct on women in the period that I'm covering, in the from 1860s to 1910. Women do appear in some of the discussions by the judicial committee, but not in the way that, like, Rita Ghosh or in this kind of, not in the same manner. And very often, as I said, women's role becomes women's issues and their different status in the within the marriage is not very explicit in these reports. They very rarely, you can very rarely see that they regarded women to have a more vulnerable status in marriage.
So when the church officials said these are extraneous foreign elements intruding into the orbit of our nation, of our cultural tradition, and so on, I would assume somebody could have said, well, what are the ones that are ours? Are they codified somewhere, or is this customary law?
No, this is, yes, this was more a discursive, this was more about making the case and about debating what was the authentic Armenian culture and what was not, and it was not based on any factual or substantial information that they had. It was more about trying to claim that because they were between Europe and they were between the Ottoman state. So the vice is very, very often, if you look through the reports or also the minutes, you will see that, for example, Dramojit and Drahomal, Deshi Kertme, all of these are reported to be foreign, borrowed from the foreigners, borrowed from the neighbors, and these are not authentic to the Armenian culture. But these are, this is on a discursive level. We do not know originally the origins, how this...
I also want to ask about sources. Mm-hmm. I'm aware, like Alskanj Olovo, Abinakar Chunka, etc., being available. I was not available, I'm not aware that the committees, Abinakar Chunka, have been available outside of Istanbul. Are they in the Bavarian Library? Where did you find your sources for that?
Well, I did research at the libraries in Armenia. Nubarian Library, Mkhitaryist congregation in Vienna.
So the Religious Council minutes, where do you find those?
I don't remember. I can I have them
in more than one place.
Let me. I don't remember. I think they've been in all of. I found them in all.
In more than
in
one
all
place.
Yes, definitely. And they were very random too. If I wanted to look the chronological development, it was not going to be possible to do that. So I had to take bigger chunks of dates, like from 1870 to 1880, and then maybe decades. And randomly, every time I took them, and then I had to kind of make my own chronology to see what the developments were and what the press was at the time reporting, and kind of bring them together to see what the picture was and what the progress was in the making of the marriage law. Yes, unfortunately, I do not think they're in one place. Yes, I definitely have found them in more than one place.
You've used them in different places.
Definitely, yes. I'm sorry, before you start.
I have a question. One of the
Was
the families.
Yeah. Between the families, but really the couples marriage, when they are open for instance, like the total difference of between the kids and the family, where they are comfortable. So that's my first question. And the second question is, was there any reverse type of marriage, like some yourself part, that it's not sort of kind of a partial force paid by the other party, and then the dowry was brought by the so that's my other question.
Let me start with the last one. I have not seen this in the sources. I don't want to say that there weren't cases, because there might have been, but nothing that I can tell from the sources that I have seen. At the same time, I don't want to give the impression that things were not changing, because the family sizes were shrinking in this period, especially in Constantinople. A lot of women in this period were also fighting for a nuclear family. And they were doing so not in the periodical place, because it would have been too brave. Home was the only shelter that they knew, family wasn't the only shelter that they knew, so they could not criticize that. But if you look into the fictional literature that women left, it's all about marriage, nuclear family, complicated relations with mother-in-laws, a happy home is when there's the husband and the wife and children, and both are working. So basically, this is this modern nuclear image of a family that we have. And the first question was?
The first question was if there was any
case. Oh, yes. Yeah. Contract. No, by when I said contract, I did not mean anything signed between the families. It just meant that there were people who hired people who were. Arranging the marriages between the families, sometimes the families themselves. It was a verbal agreement, because no, at least that's what I've seen, but I have not seen, I don't think it was any contract, it's certainly too modern.
So, if there is a dowry and then there is a sales price, so how is that determined?
Yes.
Each family, you know,
certain amount? Okay, it's about, again, if the in the rural areas, when a woman was getting married, the family was losing labor, mm-hmm. because the woman would have worked on the land and mm-hmm. So therefore, the groom had to give head price to the family, because they were losing labor, so it was to pay for the lost labor. In the city, the woman was not going to work, because it was not an industrial setting yet, and women were still in the household, so that meant that she was going to be a burden for the family where she was going. So therefore, she had to take dowry in cash with her to compensate for the burden, financial burden on that family. So this was why it was different from rural to urban space between rural and urban.
Do you know
when
these installations start? Did it begin in urban?
Where did it start?
When the difference, in the kind of monetary transaction involved in the
I don't know when it started, but it's mentioned in the earliest source that I saw as far as marriage was concerned, 1811. That was the earliest report that I saw of the reports from the Patriarchate, and in that, Drahoma and Bashulak were mentioned already. But as I said, Armenians claim, at least in the newspapers you see, that they claim these were foreign drahoma, they had learned from the Greeks, they would claim, and Bashulak was, they had learned from the Muslims.
But then these claims, these narratives are not Syrianic.
Yes,
of course. Because the period that you're mentioning involves
and also, if you want to denounce something, the best way of doing that is to claim that this is not authentic to our culture, and this is very, very emblematic for this entire period.
Let me ask you two small questions. Yes,
not contingent, it's not incidental, right? And the top national question or the family itself has been included in national solidarity project in different contexts. What I was wondering, you also mentioned that you studied the periodical literature. How did these reports resonate with the larger debate on the women's question in Armenian revolutionary negative society?
What is the question again?
How did these archival reports that you investigated resonate with the debate that were pioneered that in the pages of Armenian revolutionary magazines at the time vis-a-vis the women's question? And one more thing. Is Beshik Kagna the only word used for the arrangement? Is there an Armenian word for it?
No, Beshik Kagna, yes. Beshik Kagna, yes.
And I actually enjoyed this.
Beshik Kagna had prize, yes?
No,
Beshik Kagna is, this arrangement between the families, when the infants are born, the two families decide that they are going to have their children married when they reach the puberty.
Yes.
In the Soviet times, at least, practiced also in rural Armenia. I don't know about today, but I won't be surprised. I didn't answer your question. In this period, the periodical press, if you want to study women's movements and women's issues and anything that has to do with women's questions, the periodical press, the progressive periodical press, is the right place to go. You see everything that you need to construct at least a discursive narrative of what women's questions was in the time. But marriage and some of them that were discussed, what was the true way of being a feminist, what was the true way of being an Armenian woman, that Armenian women have to work to be independent, it was the issue of entering the labor market, it was the issue of women becoming socially more active, being involved in social work and charity. But marriage is not, women never published articles, and I've looked for many of them, really, for many years, never brought up the issue of marriage in the periodical press. So this actually came, my dissertation is on Armenian women's movement, it's not on marriage. This was a chapter in my dissertation. But how do you write a women's movement when there is no historical background to build on? So I had to do this research to make a case for women, basically. And in this particular, only in this chapter, I'm using fictional literature. In the second part of my chapter, the literary work left by these women to show how they envisioned the reform in the family. They're very brave when it comes to the fictional language. They're very brave in fictional literature. But none of this is in the periodical press. So men would men would bring up women's sufferings in the marriage. You see this in the periodical press, that women are unhappy in the families, that the extended families are working against women's interests. But you do not see women bringing this up.
Thank you for a very interesting presentation, Audrey.
Thank you.
I have a question about the process of the work. You address many issues pertaining to the outcome of the work. During the process of the work, did you see any information? Did you come upon any stories or information that had to do with counseling, family counseling, people stepping in trying to help the couple mend their differences or deal with their issues? Was there cover involved?
Yeah.
Was there the city council or whatever, the religious council involved in the process as well?
Not in the sources in these legal or semi-legal documents that I've seen, but divorce would not no couple would immediately be given the divorce. They would be given a time for trial to see if they could make it work. But what happened between the first appeal and later the divorce I'm not sure on if but given this, I would imagine yes, that there will be cover, there will be the families trying to bring them back together. Yes, but I not on the space. I can't say this support. This is not supported by my sources.
I just wanted to add something. You know, I have done also some research in the Women and Education website, for the Bashi Health Matches, as far as I know, 50,000 words, and it's like all of us have found. Oh, no, because they were kind of making the mark of the cattle, the kids.
Oh, that's very interesting.
But I'm not sure if that was, of course, based on the more of a offering tradition that they followed it and that they came up with the same similar technology. So I'm not sure about that. But yeah, that's what we need sometimes.
I have not seen that. That's very good word, actually. But in these sources that they, and this they refer to Bashi Khatna, but I wouldn't say that this was necessarily a Muslim tradition, because these cases were also were reported in Eastern Armenia. We know that in Eastern Armenia this was practiced as well. Although the main influences may go back and forth. But
yeah, it should be very early. And if I may, also about this head crying and the dowry, you know, they come back from all the way from like Hammurabi ancient years, like
and not only also European, I would say. Yes.
Head crying and the dowry, it's a stream of why do they pay the head crying? Because, you know, the labor is going out of the house, and then why do they pay the dowry?
Thank
you.
Anyone else for having? No, I don't. I have one comment. You know, those of you from the Middle East know that Ojid still exists, that women prepare for, and mothers prepare for the dowry still. But what I took away from your talk, Hasmi, and I appreciate it, was the fact that the community was aware of problems,
yeah.
Even though they were not implemented. The fact is that they were aware of them, and they had begun to work on these social issues, which I think is quite significant, and I think you brought that up clearly. And you know, it's like many laws in Armenia and other places today, they're passed, but they're not implemented. It takes a long time.
Absolutely. And the marriage issues are Muslim Khantivner, Gurtakan Khantivner, and education issues. They really predominated the minutes of the National Assembly that I looked to for this time period.
Yeah, I have a question with regard to divorce. Obviously, I think divorce is one of the major issues in this sort of sphere. And I was very curious if you could discuss that, particularly with regard to when this is brought on the part of a woman. How many obstacles are there? Obviously, it's quite a major issue. Also, in terms of the research you have conducted with regard to the constitution, so within the legal framework of Armenian blood. And then you mentioned the approach to Muslim authorities. And then I was curious about the issue that you brought about various cases being referred to the Catholic Synod of the team. And also, of course, divorce laws changing in the Russian Empire also. So this is a third sort of complicated factor.
I do not know specifically what cases could be referred to the Catholicos, but this was more a result of the reluctance of the patriarchy to take charge and do this. But as I also mentioned, in 1907, they just decided that they're no longer going to go to the Catholicos, and they will decide all cases on their own, and within Constantinople, not even the provinces were no longer authorized to make decisions on their own. Regarding the divorce, I also mentioned that Armenian women would often take their cases to the Muslim court because under Islamic law, it was easier to obtain divorce, so that was making things
faster. Imagine, particularly
for the men. For the men, yes. But there were also cases when Catholic Armenians would convert to Armenian Church because that way they could the Armenian Church regarded meant adultery as shanat sum, and therefore it would release the wife of a marriage like that. So very often Catholic Armenians would convert to Apostolic Armenian Church so that they would get divorced easily. They would go to the Greek so much so to the Greek Patriarchate, so much so that Crimean Heirich had a problem with them, and so the Greek Patriarchate to write to Crimean Heirich and say that they're no longer going to hear Armenian cases. So people were trying to find, women were trying to find their ways through all these various legal systems that they were, and to take advantage of whichever worked in their, whichever was easier to obtain.
Just one last question, Colin. Couldn't help but to be transported backwards into my graduate years, 20 years ago. So I took a class at Columbia University with my advisor at the time, Partha Chatterjee.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're aware of this.
I know very well. I've read very well.
Chapter
very
on the women's question and
nationalist
discourse. Well. And I was wondering a lot of the things about that you mentioned regarding authenticity, what is interior versus exterior, resonated with that. Have you thought about incorporating his work, or have you already incorporated
his work. For the format of this presentation, I did not mention that, but in fact, also in the conclusion, when I said that when you in the political arena you do not have the power anymore, you start practicing governance in the household, basically, in issues that are related to the household. This is a Partha Chatterjee idea. When the home becomes the only place that you try to keep it authentic, and that's the place where you can make decisions. So that also makes it more difficult for women to break in because of it. Yes, I used it throughout my dissertation. Yes, thank you.
So, thank you so much. It was
thank
a wonderful
you.
Presentation.
Thank you very much.
Raised many questions, critical questions, and thank you both for coming. We have other
I want to take a look at the Thank you.